Welcome, everybody. You probably know who I am and where I work. I've been involved in computer graphics since 1981. So what I'm going to be presenting today is kind of a personal history. I'm going to show kind of a an age regression of the technology that's involved in computer graphics. We'll see some stuff. I'm sure most of you have seen one or two things that I'm about to show. I think you'll be surprised when we start getting further back in time and you start seeing the state of the art of computer graphics back then. We've come quite a ways in 20 years, actually 25 or close to 30 that the tape that I'm going to show you has excerpts from. Let me make a little disclaimer. There's some poor quality video on this tape because a lot of it is from pretty far back, and also because one of the transfers on here was done at the wrong field dominance, so you get a little flicker in the animation, a little stutter in the animation, but I think most things on here look reasonably good, and there's some edits, so some stuff will cut from one shot to another, and the edits aren't great. I think the first thing we'll do is kind of talk about what the current state of the art is. I do work at Industrial Light & Magic. We are, you know, one, if not the top computer graphics facility. And we pretty much work exclusively for feature films and for pretty much high profile commercial spots. We have pretty much state-of-the-art equipment and a lot of software that's developed in-house to do a lot of stuff. Also a lot of software that is commercially available. We do most of the modeling using Alias software. We do most of the animation using Softimage software. We do most of our rendering using RenderMan. And we do most work on Silicon Graphics hardware and Silicon Graphics disk storage and media. Let's just take a look at some of the... Now, everything I'm going to show today, or most of the things I'm going to show today, I've worked on personally, so I'm going to show some of the shots that I've worked on some films from the last few years. I started at Industrial Light & Magic in 1994, working on a movie called Jumanji. And then I've worked on Twister, 101 Dalmatians, Lost World, Jurassic Park, Deep Impact, The Mummy, the new Star Wars movie. I can't show you footage from the new Star Wars movie. We can't show anything until it's out on video. Fortunately, The Mummy came out on video this week, so I can show some clips from that. Before Image West, before Industrial Light & Magic, I worked at a number of companies going back in time to 1981, where I started at a company called Image West, where we were actually using analog computer graphics technology. And that's what I brought this little model of a machine called Scanimate. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But let's take a look at some of the work from Industrial Light & Magic. We're talking the period of from about 1993-94 up through the present, and I'll talk about some of the capabilities of the system, or some of the things that we can do now that we did not used to be able to do, if that's proper grammar. I wonder if we could lower the lights. Is there... Okay. Does anybody know how to turn down the lights?
Big red box here.
Hey, look at that. Okay. Now, the clips from Industrial Light and Magic don't have audio on them, so I'm going to talk over it. Eventually, some of the stuff will have audio. I'll probably talk over some of that as well. It is playing. This is the first shot that I worked on at Industrial Light and Magic. This is from the movie Jumanji. Got a bunch of monkeys in there wreaking havoc. So this shows some R&D that we developed back in 1994 to create fur. This was one of the big problems of computer graphics, the successful rendering of hair and fur, and I think we were about the first ones to do it. I just wish the director had let us make the monkeys brown rather than this bright orange, but we tried. But another thing that that you'll see, another aspect of computer graphics that we can do today is very organic modeling. We model using patch surfaces as opposed to the older days where models were done using polygons. Patches allow us to get infinitely close to an object without ever seeing the straight edges of any contour. It's like modeling with a sheet of rubber, pulling points on the rubber and it stretches. So another thing that we can do now is not only the fur and the organic types of modeling, but also one of the biggest advances in the early 90s was to be able to actually use a laser scanner to actually to scan film resolution footage into the computer and turn it into digital information, and then be able to manipulate that digital information, which is at very high resolution, manipulate it digitally, in other words, composite imagery together, and scan it back out onto film. This is a development that was just in the early 90s, and it's a pretty significant one. Another thing that we can do today is not only can we sculpt organic critters, but we can also animate them using inverse kinematics, which basically means that we can create an internal skeletal structure. And rather than animating each tiny part of an animal individually, we can actually grab a hold of the base of a leg, move it, place it, and the rest of the hierarchy of the creature will move along with it. We still have to have some pretty darn talented animators to make it look real, but this inverse kinematics approach to animation is something that is new to the mid-90s. What we're also able to do in the mid-90s now is use what we call shaders, which basically allows us to define a lighting model. It used to be that we were limited in the types of lighting and the types of surface treatment that we could use, because the computer graphics packages that we would animate with had set lighting models. But what we can do now is actually write light shaders that describe mathematically how we want our lights to work. We can write shaders for surface treatment that can describe mathematically how we want the surfaces to react to light. We can also write shaders that that involve surface actual displacement. Like this vine that's wrapping around the car right now, is actually written with a displacement shader, so that the texture in the vine is not only mapped on, but actually stands off of the actual geometry of the vine. So the ability to write shaders using displacement mapping, using bump mapping, using texture mapping, image mapping, and defining how we want those images to react to computer-generated light sources is something relatively new in the 90s. Again, a lot of compositing in this shot with individual tree elements that were shot. Another thing that we can do now in the 1990s is use particle systems to create really amorphous objects. It used to be that a computer-generated object was solid, and now using particle systems which describe a volume of an object based on instancing of particles, millions of particles. I mean, there's millions of particles in this twister, and they can be rendered as soft, blurry objects. So we now in the 90s we can create all kinds of natural effects, clouds, smoke, steam, tornadoes, which up until these times was not really possible using computer graphics. You'll see a lot of examples of particle system stuff. Here I actually killed the guy in the car with this beam. It was fun. Those started out as nice, clean plates without any dust. Here's another example of where we can use particle systems. I did all the snow simulation in the movie 101 Dalmatians. This is a computer-generated dog, and he runs into this snowbank, and there's kind of fluffy snow, and there's wet snow, and there's it all gets knocked by the dog's butt as he goes skidding. This is another example of what we can do with shaders. We wrote a fur shader for the dog. That's not actually generated fur the way the monkeys were. That's simulated fur with a shader that's designed to make it look like a bunch of short hair fur.
Getting a snow job at work?
Yes. This shot has 20 real dogs and 40 CG dogs in it.
Which and which?
Well, I can tell you. Actually, they...
I've probably seen this thing a zillion times.
These couple of dogs are real, a few here. All the dogs on the floor, they obviously couldn't get 101 puppies to do exactly what the director wanted them to do, which was head toward this real dog. So all of the these dogs down here on the ground are computer generated animated. The dog that I'm most proud of is this guy right here, because he's CG and he's real. And they're standing right next to each other, and you can't tell. Wait a second, it was the other way around. So this again shows what we can now do with lighting and with some pretty fancy animation. I'm going to fast forward through some of these because they laid down the wrong takes. There were a bunch of computer-generated sparks in these shots, but when Disney did a test marketing of the film, the audiences thought the sequence was too violent, So they removed all of the computer-generated sparks to kind of reduce the violence. Here's another example of what we can do with light shaders. Make the light actually wrap around the edges of the dinosaurs to really set them into that plate. Obviously, there were no dinosaurs in the plate when they shot it. Another example of particle systems used to create the dust at their feet as they walk.
Where did they shoot these this
train? I'm not sure where these plates were shot, actually. I think Hawaii, but I'm not sure. Things like putting reflections in the water, that's computer generated. Compositing practical elements when he steps through that wall, that's an actual shoot of a wall breaking. And I was able to put it in the shot so it looked like it was part of the scene. Here's another kind of lighting effect that we can do, which is a Kukulorus effect. What that means is basically we can put a slide into our computer-generated light so that the effect that we're getting of the shadows on the object on the plate is also reflected in the CG critters in the shot. That is something that's relatively new in the 90s as well. Yeah, if you think that was bad, look at this one. He's in deep doo-doo. We can also do computer-generated rack focus now. I don't know if you noticed that the focal plane changed over the course of this shot. Here we're in tight focus on him, so these guys are out of focus in the background. That's not a compositing trick. That's actually done in the render, where I actually simulated the lens and the change in focus according to where the focal plane was. This is from the movie Deep Impact. Diving down into a planet. This was, or into the core of an asteroid. And here I actually saved the Earth. I don't know if you saw the film, but.
Actually, you probably destroyed it with that process.
Yeah.
Because if you take an asteroid that close and blow it into a million pieces, it's actually better to have it hit as one solid piece than to have it hit as multiple pieces, because you just fry everybody that's on the Earth below it.
Well, the intent of that shot was to show that each of the tiny pieces was evaporating as it hit the atmosphere.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Talk to Mimi later. She directed the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
This is another way we can use particle systems. What I did was animated simulations of a number of particles using collision detection so that the particles actually start out in a computer-generated geometry that fits that urn, and they get poured into this coffin, and I have computer-generated geometry that matches exactly to the coffin, and the particles actually interact with each other and collide, and then I instanced an animating scarab to each one of those particles. So particle simulations are another aspect of doing computer graphics in the mid to late 90s. I actually have a little drain. There were too many of them gathering up in his head, so to the left of his head there's a drain. If you look at the untreated animation, you see them falling down under the panel. So this was a way of controlling literally 10,000 animating creatures all at once. And the ones here at the top in these shots, those actually start out in the simulation down at the bottom and work their way up. They come up, they cross, they turn.
Which are the real scarabs?
There was only one real scarab.
the silicon graphic machine you use to render these, so what size is that?
Well, we have a number of them. It's a distributed system. We use pretty much everybody. They can be rendered on the individual workstations, which are O2s, 256 megs. Actually, I just got mine bumped up to 512 megs. And then we have Oxygen O2000s as the render servers. So there's a lot of firepower. And this is the scene at the end of The Mummy. Not much really of note computer graphics-wise, although these are computer graphics elements, but the smoke and stuff was actually practically shot as actual smoke elements and then composited in. The crumbling wall in the middle there is a real crumbling wall. The one on the left is CG. Because at the last minute they said, you know, this crumbling wall looks so great, and we hadn't shot a crumbling wall on the left, so we had to do that, come up with a way to do it computer graphics. Okay, so that's kind of the state of the art as it stands now, but let's start like delving back into the past a little bit. This is my demo reel from the years. Well, this has a few little bits and pieces of the early 80s, but most of the stuff on this reel you're about to see is from 1987 to about 1991. And there are some pretty major differences in this technology and the technology that we just saw. I'll talk about what was new in this technology, but first let's take a look at it. Thank you. That's what got me the job at ILM, by the way. So what we were seeing in that work from about 1987 to about 1991 is a lot of polygonal objects, not patch-based objects. Everything, if it appeared smooth, it was because we used lots and lots and lots of polygons, but if you had gotten right up to the edge, you would have seen that they were all just flat-edged objects. During that time, we saw the actual introduction of a technique called reflection mapping, which was used to create kind of a metallic look for objects. That was relatively new in the late 80s. We had seen it a little bit earlier in some of the boutique work done at places like Robert Abel and Cranston Suri, but as far as being commercially available to a number of facilities, the late 80s saw reflection mapping, texture mapping, and bump mapping, not displacement mapping yet though. So we could make a surface look bumpy, but if you turned it on its side, you wouldn't see any of those bumps sticking out. Yes?
Who did Chromosaurus?
Chromosaurus was Pacific Data Images. That was one of the first times that anybody had seen reflection mapping. Actually, the very first time that people saw reflection mapping was the sexy robot spot from Robert Abel and Associates. But this was from a machine or a system called Wavefront. Most of this reel was done using Wavefront Technologies software. And that was really the first commercially available reflection mapping system. What we also saw in here was at the beginning there was that radio that kind of stretched and squashed. That was the first time we saw the use of non-linear deformations, something other than a scaling or a translating or a rotating object, but an actual shape stretching and bending. That was new in the late 80s as well. So most of that was done with a one shading model. We couldn't actually write our own shaders, but we could simulate the effect of different shaders, so it didn't all look like one shading model, but pretty much it was. And all the modeling was done. Yeah.
When did motion blur come in?
The Wavefront had motion blur. You'll see in the next, and motion blur was a big step forward as well, and that was really the first time that I was working with a motion blurring system. Now we're gonna move a little bit, just a little bit further into the past, and you'll see a big difference. The reel that I'm about to show you was when I was working in, the reel that we just saw was when I was at Crawford Design Effects in Atlanta, Georgia, and also when I was at NASA in Houston. That Mars rover stuff was from 1987. And the reason that looked so polygonal was because it had to match in with footage that was done 2 years earlier, which was very polygonal in nature. But in that Mars piece, that was the first time I had worked on Wavefront. That was the first time I had worked with cast shadows, which was a new development. And it was also the first time I had worked with bump mapping and texture with bump mapping. Now, before that, from 1983 to 1985, I was at a company in New York called CompuGraph Designs, and what we were using there was pretty much the first digital 3D system that was commercially available. It was called the Bosch FGS 4000. That is the same Robert Bosch company that creates spark plugs and airplane engines and all that. They also create, or at the time they were into the video technology business, and they really created the first commercially available 3D animation system. I remember I saw it at NAB in 1980, the National Association of Broadcasters Conference in 1983. And all they had was a top spinning on a table, and it spun, and it moved across the surface of the table, and there was a camera circling around the whole thing, and it was all very simple polygonal renderings, but I was blown away to see hierarchical animation in 3D that, and the next year I was actually working on one of these systems. So that was introduced in 83. Another digital device that was introduced at the same time was the Quantel Paint Box. This was the first real, there were a few that came before, but this was the first real artist-friendly digital paint system for the professional high-end user. And at CompuGraph we had a very talented artist, Janet Scabrini, who was very good at rotoscoping. That became a hallmark of the early to mid 1980s computer graphics look. Because of the paint box, you could actually take video and frame by frame you could paint right over it. And at the same time, the Bosch FGS 4000 allowed us to create three-dimensional objects. Very simple lighting model, very simple geometry, and another thing I failed to mention in the previous reel, we saw the first use of refraction, in that now it can be told rotating cube, and the first use of real transparency in glass. When we were doing transparency with the Bosch, it just meant that there was a level of transparency to it, but it did not look like glass. So this is what pretty much was on television as state of the art in 1983, 84, and a little into 85. This is from CompuGraph Designs. This is the stuff that has that little stutter in it. So when this stuff was actually on TV, it did not have this little stuttery look. One of the most famous pieces that came out of this era was the Money for Nothing music video that was also done with the Quantel paint box and the Bosch FGS 4000. This was the first time we were actually using Phong shading to make things look like they had highlights, and it was also one of the first times we could actually texture map an image onto a moving piece of three-dimensional geometry. This was the package that we designed for Lifetime when they premiered. And all of the reflections here are fake. We would just use video tricks to actually mix it in and fade it back a little bit so it looked like reflections. This was when it was cool just to see things flying in 3D space. And this isn't that long ago. That was 1984. Also on the Bosch, here's probably one of the most well-known pieces that that we did at the time. Also on the Bosch, there was a hierarchy. But the hierarchy did not determine which object was rendered on top of another object. It was rendered properly in 3D space, but it wasn't rendered properly one object. You had to actually specifically say, this object will be on top of this object. And if it had to be behind it and then eventually move around to be in front of it, you had to make two copies of it, turn one of them off and one of them on at the appropriate moment. So those reflections are fake. That's not real reflections. And the cast shadows were all fake. And you can see it really suffers from a lack of motion blur. This was the most number of objects in the Bosch ever used at one time. That's me over there. the penguin on my shirt.
Like Alfred Hitchcock, I always get into every scene.
Yeah, well, that's the only one that I've done. if I did it in every scene, everybody in the world would know me. So now we're going to get into, like, you know, this is the Vintage Computer Festival. Now we're going to get into some vintage computer stuff. Because this the stuff that you just saw was pretty much the beginning of the digital three-dimensional object rendering time period. But before that, there was a transitional period where we were doing computer graphics using analog computers. And I'm going to show you the System 4, which was a machine. All of the major analog devices were created at a company called Computer Image in Denver, and were pretty much the founder of Computer Image, Lee Harrison. It was pretty much a concept that he created, which was to use the video signal as the input and to manipulate something electronically by manipulating how that video signal was drawn onto the CRT. I'm going to show a piece that actually explains the process and shows you what the System 4 looked like. The first machines that Computer Image Corporation created were called Scanimate, and that's why I have this little model of Scanimate here. We're going to see those a little bit later. Scanimate was totally analog. That's the machine that I started out on in 1981. It was programmed by plugging little wires into patch panels, turning knobs, flipping switches, connecting electronic circuitry. Later, they developed the machine that we're about to see, which is called System 4, which was a digital front end to an analog machine. So the output was still analog, but the input looks like a bright, shiny digital computer. It's a shame this is no longer being used, and the keyboard that you're going to see in this video is actually on a friend of mine's wall right now. And that's all that's left of this System 4, which was a million-dollar computer at the time. This was made in 1983. This is when I was at Editel in Los Angeles. I've been around.
Hi, welcome to Editel in Hollywood. I'm Ed Kramer, a member of the Los Angeles SIGGRAPH, and this is Editel Animation Services, where we produce computer animation totally using video technology. This is System 4. The state of the art in real-time 3D video animation. Because we work in video, we can program our animation, view it almost immediately, make any changes, and when it looks just right, we're ready to record it. There's no waiting for film labs or for mainframes to print an image pixel by pixel. The input to System 4 comes primarily from these artwork cameras in the form of high-contrast codaliths. Frequently, we'll airbrush a texture on an overlay cell. This image is then fed to a high-resolution CRT in System 4. System 4 can then section the artwork and affect each of the sections in a number of ways. The controller works in a hierarchy so that individual sections can be manipulated independently, as well as in overall groups. This simple animation illustrates the various parameters that can be controlled in real 3D space. Animation is created by entering keyframes, and then System 4, of course, calculates the in-between positions. Because this is a video system, we can place diffusion filters and other optical interfaces on the CRT, giving us different treatments of the same animation. So now, to show how it all goes together to create animation, let's move downstairs to Edit Bay 2, where Terry Craig, another LA SIGGRAPH member, will explain the video switcher, and how we produce the animated logo for UNLV.
Thanks, Ed. This is a video production switcher, which is used to combine video images in a variety of ways. Its most useful function for video animation is the key. The key mode allows us to superimpose one video image on top of another. Here's the way it works. The keying signal cuts a hole in the background, and this hole can be filled either with the keying image itself, or with a color, or with a totally different image. This switcher is capable of keying multiple images at the same time, but our animation is usually so complex that we have to make it in stages. Each stage is recorded on videotape and becomes the background to the next stage. Complex animations require a lot of planning, and so we make up flowcharts which diagram each of the production steps. Now let's take a look at the UNLV logo and briefly discuss how we made it. First, we made four moving Nevadas on System 4. Then we created the 12 random lasers. We tried different optical interfaces and decided on this look. We used the moving Nevadas as a key through which we saw the lasers. We called these Nevada pieces. Then we made a star field on System 4 and modified it to get this streaking effect. We began to combine images by keying the Nevada pieces over the lasers and that over the star field. Next, we added sparkles where the lasers hit the Nevada pieces. To make the zoom into Las Vegas, first we made the zoom on Nevada and keyed it black over the star field. The next step was to create the white glow and blue outline over black. To complete the front end, we added the beginning sparkle and the blue glows on the Nevada pieces. Next, we located this terrific stock footage of clouds, supplied to us by the good folks at Energy Productions in Hollywood. We achieved this look by recording it twice and playing them back out of synchronization through a concentric circle keyhole. We dissolved from the opening to the treated clouds. Then we made this rotating fiery sphere on System 4 and keyed that over the back half while keying the Las Vegas sparkle over the transition. This entire piece was created from start to finish in only 2 days, thanks to System 4 and real-time video production.
I really was there. Okay, well, System 4 was kind of a hybrid of the analog, the strictly analog stuff, and digital front end. It also could do things like to shrink the entire raster image to a dot and make that dot move very quickly in 3D space and trace out three-dimensional outlines. So you'll see in the reel coming up, there's a rotating wireframe car. That was done with System 4 because it could work in 3D space and we could create very crude wireframe objects. But what we were doing to create three-dimensional objects before System 4, when we were only using the Scanimate, is actually pretty funny. If a logo needed to be in 3D, we would carve it out of balsa wood. I'm not kidding. This is at a company called Image West in Hollywood, where I was working from 1981 to early 1983. We would carve the logo out of balsa wood, and there was a company in Hollywood that did that professionally. We would paint the front surface of the logo white, paint all the side edges gray, mount it on a dowel, a wooden dowel, and connect that dowel to a stepper motor that was being controlled by an Apple IIe computer. So it was digital. And then we would put that in a chroma key blue studio, which we had at Image West. And so we would control the rotation of the stepper motor to do the rotation of the 3D logo. And on Scanimate, we could make a moving gold-looking texture and key that into the white areas. make a darker moving gold texture, key that into the gray sides, and then chroma key the whole thing out and put it over a star field that we could make on the Scanimate as well. So you had a rotating 3D gold shining logo with all the sparkles you wanted over a star field flying through space. It looked great, and it was 3D, and this was before there really was a way to do these with digital computers properly or popularly. Now, there were boutique animation companies like Robert Abel and Associates and a few others that were experimenting with doing three-dimensional animation at the same time, but it was extremely high-end. It took extremely long production schedules. You could come to Image West, and we could have something on the air that night if you needed it. So at Image West, we did a lot of a vast majority of the work that actually was on television, as opposed to places like Robert Abel, who would work for 6 months on one 30-second spot. It would be gorgeous. But so I'm not implying that there was nothing else going on at the time, but this was the majority of what was going on at the time. So I'm going to show you a demo reel of mine from the analog era that has some Scanimate work, has some System 4 work on it, and this is what television graphics looked like from 1980 through about 1983. We could also put sparkle filters in front of the CRT so we could get these little sparkles. We could put any kind of filters that we wanted, shower glass, so we could get all kinds of effects optically that way. Everything glowed. Everything had streaks. So that's just a shower glass in front of the CRT to make those little sparkles. And here's the System 4 drawing on a 3D object. This was the opening to the Merv Griffin Show in 1982. This was also one of the first applications of the Ampex Digital Optics, a machine that could take full color video footage and move it in 3D space. And everything drew itself on. There's those sparkles. This was a fun piece that we did stop motion and then treated in the System 4 to give it all the glows. A little washed out on this projector, obviously. Yeah, I said that some of these tapes are kind of old. This is one that's kind of old and it's gone down a number of generations. But at the time, this stuff looked pristine. I did the opening to the World Series in 1982 on this technology, so it was being used at the highest level of television production. These cards were mounted on a piece of black felt, and I was panning a camera across it, and then I went back and replaced them with white cards to create the mats for them, and did the same camera pan. There's a System 4 three-dimensional object. This is also a three-dimensional object from the System 4. This is Scanimate again. It used to be legible. This was the Canadian equivalent of HBO, called First Choice Canadian. Image West was owned by Canadians. So we did a lot of work for Canada, also a lot of work for Mexico. There's a 3D object on System 4. A few things come up every now and then in two videos. It's not on here, but I actually did the most recent Columbia Pictures logo when I was in 1992. So the one that you see in theaters now, I did that one. It's not a real 3D object, that was just a drawing. Notice how it doesn't move in perspective. We were into doing lots of tricks to make people think we could do 3D stuff. Those sparkles were also done with the Apple II. Controlling the, giving a random instancing to the video raster itself. That sayout was one of the examples of a rotating 3D object that was made out of balsa wood.
It was
done by a we matted them out. It's hard for me to remember from back then how we did that.
Yeah.
We were tricky with how we painted them. The image, it could have been made as one object, and the negative spaces painted blue, and then they would have dropped out in the chroma key. I actually worked with Leonard Nimoy. This played on, for years, Hitachi used this. I made my salary that day. At Image West, they were charging $1,500 an hour for my time, and I made $15,000 a year. That was 10 hours of my time to justify my yearly salary. No royalties.
What is the rough ratio compared to the original days to nowadays of man cost versus machine cost?
Has
it remained about the same, or has it gone up one or the other?
Well, I'd say it's definitely gone up because just the yeah, I also did the sound effects for this. This was a video game called Space Sucker. I'm not really sure how the cost ratios has changed over time. I don't know how much Industrial Light and Magic charges to do the effects that we do, but I guarantee you it's significant.
Yeah. But I mean, is it mostly for the man hours or the machine, basically?
It's both. I would say, well, at a company like Industrial Light and Magic, for production like The Mummy, we had like maybe 50 or 60 people involved in that production, and we used a load of computer time. So I have no idea how it breaks down people versus machine time, but it's substantial. I know time is getting scarce. 5 minutes, okay? Let's just look at some real early Scanimate stuff. See the Scanimate machine.
Image West, creativity in electronic animation.
I'm just going to fast forward through some of this. There it is.
Production facility, there is.
She just said the most high-tech production facility there is. So this is some of the early classic vintage Image West work. This is from the 1976 Olympics. This was the opening to the 1976 Olympics on ABC. Just right out of Scanimate. Nice colors. This is some other stuff. This is what TV graphics looked like in the mid 70s. I'm going to kind of fast forward through some of this stuff, but you can recognize some. Here's a classic, two classic pieces of Scanimate. And everybody remembers the Wide World of Sports Open. Dolphin Productions was another Scanimate production company. They were located in New York.
Is ABC's Wide World of Sports.
Now here's one of the most famous Scanimate effects.
You do, wherever you go, sooner or later, you are going to get indigestion.
Anybody remember this?
Pepto-Bismol. It coats, soothes, relieves.
Now, Scanimate was also used in feature films. I'm going to fast forward through this because we're limited on time. It was used in Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was used in Logan's Run. And it was used in Demon Seed. And this is so funny.
Wow.
What?
It's a television series, not the movie.
Yes. Actually, it was used in the movie as well. Fast forward through some of this. Here's another look at the Scanimate. These are the wires that we used. This was my first job in the industry, was working on that machine right there. Excuse me? At the time, yes. And the weirder the beard, the better, as you saw in my earlier video. This is the most famous piece ever done on Scanimate.
Yes.
I don't know if, how many, did anybody ever see a movie called Star Wars? So those are pretty much the four movies that Scanimate was used on. Now I'm going to show you a special treat. This is really rarely seen footage coming up. This stuff. These are two. Let me just preface this by saying there was one other machine that was created at Computer Image Corporation called the Caesar. Computer animated effects using single axis rotation. I don't know how they came up with that name, but it was a machine that they designed specifically to do Saturday morning animation, character animation, using this analog video technology. And these, as far as I know, these are two of the only pieces that were ever actually done, but these are quite funny as well. But you'll be able to see the analog effects in these. And then...
All right, men, fill in those blanks on the left. Let's get a little more firepower here.
Excuse me there, General Custer, but I think you should take the time out now to talk to the men.
What's that? Talk? About what?
About their wheels, sir. You see, a lot of them don't have any wheels.
Are you crazy? Can't you see I'm busy here? Just look at all those...
I know, sir, that's a common excuse, but everybody should make the time to visit their legal assistance officer to see about making out a wheel. After all, you never know when something might happen to you, and if you haven't seen to it that your family is taken care of, well, where does that leave them?
Maybe you're right.
Of course I'm right, sir. And if you'll just talk to the men, I know it will do a world of good. They listen to you, sir. Why, they'd follow you anyplace.
Yes, well, all right. Where should I talk to them?
Well, right here, sir. I figure we could just have them form a little circle out there.
Have you seen your legal assistance officer about a will? Don't wait too long. You never know when it might be too late.
There used to be a time not so long ago when me and the boys could put the screws to a guy who owed us money. We'd push him around a little. You know, nothing serious, of course. Scared a wife a little too, maybe. And hit on his boss. If none of that succeeded in getting a message across, we'd make him an offer he couldn't refuse. Now all that's changed. We got this new law, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. We can't bug employers no more. We can't make no more midnight calls. We can't even harass the guy who owes us the money. What's this country coming to, huh? Everybody got rights nowadays. But what about the rights of guys like me, huh? People who helped make America what it is today. I think I'm gonna go back to the old country. That's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna go back home and I'm gonna grow olives.
So there you go. A little history of computer graphics. Any questions at this point?
5 years from now, when you show today's clips, where are you going to be laughing at?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, animation is only going to get more and more lifelike and realistic. Probably in the next 5 years, we're going to see a completely computer-generated human being. That's totally believable. I'll still be laughing at this stuff. I don't think I'll be laughing at the early Industrial Light and Magic work. I mean, it's holding up. You know, T2 is still a killer movie, and those effects are great. The Abyss still holds up. So, you know, I think that the stuff that has always looked state-of-the-art will still look pretty darn cool. The Jumanji stuff's still going to look pretty realistic. But who knows what we're going to be able to do in the future. With Deep Impact, we started doing some pretty amazing water simulation. I'm sure we're going to get some really cool fluid dynamics in the next few years that there's something in the works along those lines for about this time next year, you'll see. Things will just be so realistic that you won't have any idea they were done CG. I'll stick around for a few minutes for anybody who wants to talk or come up.
Okay, yeah. We're going to have to get Jim on.
Okay.
Go out and meet him in the hallway.
Okay.